Dream of Armageddon by H.G. Wells. Part 1. The man with the white face entered the carriage at Rugby. Even while he was still on the platform, I noted how ill he seemed. He dropped into the corner over against me with a sigh, his eyes staring vacantly. Presently he was moved by a sense of my observation, and looked up at me. I feigned to read. I feared I had unwittingly embarrassed him, and in a moment I was surprised to find him speaking. "I beg your pardon?" "That book," he repeated, pointing a lean finger. "It's about dreams." "Obviously," I answered, for it was Fortnum Roscoe's Dream States, and the title was on the cover. He hung silent for a space, as if he sought words. "Yes," he said at last, "but they tell you nothing." I looked a little more attentively at his face. "There are dreams," he said, "and dreams." That sort of proposition I never dispute. "I suppose," he hesitated, "do you ever dream? I mean, vividly?" "I dream very little," I answered.
"Your dreams don't mix with your memories? You don't find yourself in doubt, did this happen or did it not?"
"Well, hardly ever, except just for a momentary hesitation now and then."
"Does he say," he indicated the book,
"says it happens at times, and gives the usual explanation about intensity of impression and the like to account for its not happening as a rule. I suppose you know something of these theories?"
"Very little, except that they are wrong."
His emaciated hand played with the strap of the window for a time. I prepared to resume reading, and that seemed to precipitate his next remark. He leant forward, almost as though he would touch me.
"Isn't there something called consecutive dreaming that goes on night after night?"
"I believe there is. There are cases given in most books on mental trouble."
"Mental trouble? Yes, I dare say there are. It's the right place for them. But what I mean," he looked at his bony knuckles, "is that sort of thing always dreaming, or is it something else?"
I should have snubbed his persistent conversation but for the drawn anxiety of his face. I remember now the look of his faded eyes and the lids red-stained. Perhaps you know that look.
"I'm not just arguing about a matter of opinion," he said. "The thing's killing me."
"Dreams?"
"If you call them dreams. Night after night. Vivid. So vivid. This," he indicated the landscape that went streaming by the window, "seems unreal in comparison. I can scarcely remember who I am."
He paused.
"Even now."
"The dream is always the same, do you mean?" I asked.
"It's over."
"You mean?"
"I died."
"Died?"
"Smashed and killed. And now, so much of me as that dream was, is dead. I dreamt I was another man, you know, living in a different part of the world and in a different time. Night after night I woke into that other life. Fresh scenes and fresh happenings, until I came upon the last."
"When you died?"
"Yeah, when I died."
"And since then?"
"No," he said. "Oh, thank God. That was the end of the dream."
It was clear I was in for this dream, and after all I had an hour before me, the light was fading fast, and Fortnum Roscoe has a dreary way with him. "Living in a different time," I said.
"Do you mean in some different age?" "Yes."
"Past?"
"No. To come. To come."
"The year 3000, for example?"
"I don't know what year it was. I did when I was dreaming, but not now. Not now that I'm awake. There's lots of things I've forgotten since I woke out of these dreams. They called the year differently from our way of calling the year. What did they call it?"
He put his hand to his forehead.
"No," said he. "I forget."
For a moment I feared he did not mean to tell me his dream. As a rule, I hate people who tell their dreams, but this struck me differently. I proffered assistance, even.
"It began," I suggested. It was vivid from the first. I seemed to wake up in it suddenly. And it's curious that in these dreams I'm speaking of, I never remembered this life I am living now. It seemed as if the dream life was enough while it lasted. I don't remember anything clearly until I found myself sitting in a sort of loggia, looking out over the sea. I had been dozing, and suddenly I woke up, fresh and vivid, not a bit dreamlike, because the girl had stopped fanning me.
The girl?
Yes, the girl. You must not interrupt, or you will put me out. He stopped abruptly.
You won't think I'm mad, he said.
No, I answered. Tell me your dream. I woke up, I say, because the girl had stopped fanning me. I was not surprised to find myself there, or anything of that sort, you understand. Whatever memory I had of this life, this 19th century life, faded as I woke, vanished like a dream. I knew all about myself, knew that my name was no longer Cooper, but Heedon, and all about my position in the world. I've forgotten a lot since I woke. There's a want of connection, but it was all quite clear and matter-of-fact then. This seems bosh to you?
No, no, I cried. Go on. Tell me what this lodger was like.
It faced south. It was small. It was all in shadow except the semicircle above the balcony that showed the sky and sea and the corner where the girl stood. I was on a couch. It was a metal couch with light striped cushions, and the girl was leaning over the balcony with her back to me. The light of the sunrise fell on her ear and cheek, her pretty white neck and the little curls that nestled there, and her white shoulder were in the sun, and all the grace of her body was in the cool blue shadow. She was dressed, how can I describe it? It was easy and flowing, and it came to me how beautiful and desirable she was, as though I had never seen her before. When at last I sighed and raised myself upon my arm, she turned her face to me. He stopped. I have lived 53 years in this world. I have had mother, sisters, friends, wife and daughters. All their faces, the play of their faces, I know. But the face of this girl, it is much more real to me. I can bring it back into memory so that I see it again. I could draw it or paint it. He stopped, but I said nothing. The face of a dream. She was beautiful. Not that beauty which is terrible, cold and worshipful, like the beauty of a saint, nor that beauty that stirs fierce passions, but a sort of radiation, sweet lips that softened into smiles and grave grey eyes. He stopped, and his face was downcast and hidden. Then he looked up at me and went on, making no further attempt to disguise his absolute belief in the reality of his story. You see, I had thrown up my plans and ambitions, thrown up all I had ever worked for or desired for her sake. I had been a master man away there in the north, with influence and property and a great reputation, but none of it had seemed worth having beside her. I had come to the place, this city of sunny pleasures, with her, and left all those things to wreck and ruin just to save a last remnant at least of my life. While I had been in love with her before I knew that she had any care for me, before I had imagined she would dare, that we should dare, all my life had seemed vain and hollow, dust and ashes. It was dust and ashes. But it is impossible for one man to tell another these things. It's emotion, it's a tint, a light that comes and goes. Only while it's there, everything changes. Everything. The thing is, I came away and left them in their crisis to do what they could.
Left whom? I asked, puzzled.
The people up in the north there. You see, in this dream, anyhow, I had been a big man. The sort of man men come to trust in, to group themselves about. Millions of men who had never seen me were ready to do things and risk things because of their confidence in me. I'd been playing that game for years, that vague, monstrous political game amidst intrigues and betrayals, speech and agitation. It was a vast, weltering world, and at last I had a sort of leadership against the gang. You know, it was called the gang, a sort of compromise of scoundrelly projects and base ambitions and vast public emotional stupidities and catchwords. The gang that kept the world noisy and blind year by year, and all the while that it was drifting towards infinite disaster. But I can't expect you to understand the shades and complications of the year something or other ahead. I had it all, down to the smallest details, in my dream. I suppose I had been dreaming of it before I awoke. I sat up on the couch and remained looking at the woman and rejoicing. Rejoicing that I had come away out of all that tumult and folly and violence before it was too late. After all, I thought, this is life. Love and beauty, desire and delight. Are they not worth all those dismal struggles for vague, gigantic ends? And I blamed myself for having ever sought to be a leader when I might have given my days to love. But then, thought I, if I had not spent my early days sternly and austerely, I might have wasted myself upon vain and worthless women. And at the thought, all my being went out in love and tenderness to my dear mistress, my dear lady, who had come at last and compelled me to lay that life aside. "You are worth it," I said, speaking without intending her to hear. "You are worth it, my dearest one, worth pride and praise and all things." And at the murmur of my voice, she turned about. "Come and see," she cried. I can hear her now. "Come and see the sunrise upon Monte Solaro." I remember how I sprang to my feet and joined her at the balcony. I noted the sunlight on her face, caressing the lines of her cheeks and neck. How can I describe to you the scene we had before us? We were at Capri.
"I have been there," I said. "I have clambered up Monte Solaro and drunk Vero Capri. It's muddy stuff like cider. At the summit."
"Ah," said the man with the white face, "then perhaps you can tell me. You will know if this is indeed Capri. For in this life I've never been there. Let me describe it. We were in a little room, hollowed out of the limestone of a sort of cape, very high above the sea. The whole island, you know, was one enormous hotel, complex beyond explaining. And on the other side there were miles of floating hotels and huge floating stages to which the flying machines came. They called it a pleasure city. Of course, there was none of that in your time. Rather, I should say, is none of that now. Well, this room of ours was at the extremity of the cape, so that one could see east and west. Eastward was a great cliff, and beyond it the Isle of the Sirens. When one turned west, distinct and near was a little bay, a little beach still in shadow. And out of that shadow rose Solaro, straight and tall. Before us, from east to west, stretched the many-tinted sea, all dotted with little sailing boats. And just below us was a rock with an arch worn through it. The blue sea-water broke to green and foam all round the rock, and a galley came gliding out of the arch.
"I know that rock," I said. "I was nearly drowned there. It is called the Faraglione."
"I Faraglione?" "Yes, she called it that," answered the man with the white face. "There was some story, but that..." He put his hand to his forehead again. "No," he said. "No, I forget that story." Well, that is the first thing I remember. The first dream I had. That little shaded room, and the beautiful air and sky, and that dear lady of mine, and how we sat and talked in half whispers to one another. We talked in whispers, not because there was anyone to hear, but because there was still such a freshness of mind between us that our thoughts were a little frightened, I think, to find themselves at last in words. Presently we were hungry, and we went from our apartment, going by a strange passage with a moving floor, until we came to the great breakfast room. There was a fountain and music. We sat and ate and smiled at one another, and I would not heed a man who was watching me from a table nearby. And afterwards we went on to the dancing hall. But I cannot describe that hall. The place was enormous, larger than any building you've ever seen,
and in one place there was the gate of Old Capri, caught in the wall of a gallery high overhead. Light girders, stems and threads of gold burst from the pillars like fountains, streamed like an aurora across the roof, and interlaced like conjuring tricks. All about the great circle for the dancers there were beautiful figures, strange dragons, and intricate and wonderful grotesques bearing lights. And as we went through the throng, the people turned about and looked at us, for all through the world my name and face were known, and how I had suddenly thrown up pride and struggle to come to this place. And they looked also at the lady beside me, though half the story of how at last she had come to me was unknown or mistold. And few of the men who were there, I know, but judged me a happy man, in spite of all the shame and dishonour that had come upon my name. Thousands of beautiful people swarmed about the hall, crowded in galleries, sat in myriad recesses. They were dressed in splendid colours and crowned with flowers. Thousands danced about the great circle beneath the white images of the ancient gods, and glorious processions of youths and maidens came and went. We too danced. Not the dreary monotonies of your days, of this time, I mean, but dances that were beautiful, intoxicating. And even now I can see my lady dancing joyously. She danced, you know, with a serious dignity. And yet she was smiling at me and caressing me with her eyes. The music was different, he murmured. It went... I cannot describe it, but it was infinitely richer and more varied than any music that has ever come to me awake. And then, it was when we had done dancing, a man came to speak to me. He was a lean, resolute man, very soberly clad for that place, and already I had marked his face watching me in the breakfasting hall, and afterwards, as we went along the passage, I had avoided his eye. But now, as we sat in a little alcove, he came and touched me and spoke to me so that I was forced to listen. And he asked that he might speak to me for a little time apart. No, I said, I have no secrets from this lady. What do you want to tell me? He glanced at her, as though he would almost appeal to her. Then he asked me suddenly if I had heard of a great and avenging declaration that Evesham had made. Now, Evesham had always before been the man next to myself in the leadership of that great party in the north. He was a forcible, hard, and tactless man, and only I had been able to control and soften him. It was on his account, even more than my own, I think, that the others had been so dismayed at my retreat. So this question about what he had done reawakened my old interest in the life I had put aside just for a moment. I have taken no heed of any news for many days, I said. What has Evesham been saying? And with that the man began, and even I was struck by Evesham's reckless folly. He not only told me of Evesham's speech, but went on to ask counsel and to point out what need they had of me. While he talked, my lady sat a little forward and watched his face and mine. My old habits of scheming and organizing reasserted themselves. I could even see myself suddenly returning to the north. And then I thought of my lady. You see, how can I tell you? There were certain peculiarities of our relationship which would render her presence with me impossible. I should have had to leave her. Indeed, I should have had to renounce her clearly and openly if I was to do all that I could do in the north. And the man knew that, even as he talked to her and me, knew it as well as she did, that my steps to duty were, first, separation, then abandonment. At the touch of that thought, my dream of a return was shattered. I turned on the man suddenly. What have I to do with these things now? I have done with them. Why cannot you leave me alone? I have ceased to be anything but a private man. Yes, he answered, but have you thought? This talk of war, these reckless challenges, these wild aggressions... I stood up. No, I cried. I won't hear you. He seemed to consider the possibility of persistence. He looked from me to where the lady sat, regarding us. War, he said, as if he were speaking to himself, and then slowly turned from me and walked away. I stood, caught in the whirl of thoughts his appeal had set going.
I heard my lady's voice. "Dear," she said, "but if they had need of you..." She did not finish her sentence. She let it rest there. I turned to her sweet face, and the balance of my mood swayed and reeled. "They want me only to do the thing they dare not do themselves," I said. "If they distrust Evesham, they must settle with him themselves." "But war," she said. I saw a doubt on her face that I had seen before, a doubt of herself and me. The first shadow of the discovery that, seen strongly and completely, must drive us apart forever. "My dear one," I said, "there will be no war. The age of wars is past. Trust me to know the justice of this case. I have been free to choose my life, and I have chosen this." "But war," she said. I sat down beside her and took her hand in mine. I set myself to drive that doubt away. I lied to her, and in lying to her, I also lied to myself. And she was only too ready to believe me, only too ready to forget. Very soon the shadow had gone, and we were hastening to our bathing place in the Grotta del Bovo Marino, where it was our custom to bathe every day. We swam, and then we sat to bask in the sun. Presently I nodded, resting my head against her knee, and she put her hand upon my hair and stroked it softly, and I dozed. And behold, I was awakening, and I was in my own bed in Liverpool, in the life of today. Only for a time I could not believe that all these vivid moments had been no more than a dream. In truth, I could not believe it a dream for all the sobering reality of things about me. I bathed and dressed, as it were, by habit, and as I shaved, I argued why I, of all men, should leave the woman I loved to go back to politics in the North. Even if Evesham did force the world back to war, what was that to me? Why should I feel the responsibility of a deity for the way the world might go? You know, that is not quite the way I think about affairs, about my real affairs. I'm a solicitor, you know, with a point of view. The vision was so real, you must understand, so utterly unlike a dream, that I kept perpetually recalling little irrelevant details. Even the gilt line that ran about the seat in the alcove where I had talked with the messenger from my deserted party. Have you ever heard of a dream that had a quality like that? Like, so that afterwards you remembered little details you'd forgotten? I thought. I had never noticed the point before, but he was right. "Never," I said. "That is what you never seem to do with dreams." "No," he answered, "but that's just what I did. I am a solicitor in Liverpool, and I could not help wondering what the clients and business people I found myself talking to in my office would think if I told them suddenly I was in love with a girl who would be born a couple of hundred years or so hence, and worried about the politics of my great-great-great-grandchildren. I was chiefly busy that day negotiating a 99-year building lease. It was a private builder in a hurry, and he showed a certain want of temper that sent me to bed irritated. That night I had no dream. Something of that intense reality of conviction vanished. I began to feel sure it was a dream. And then it came again. When the dream came again, nearly 4 days later, it was very different. I think it's certain that 4 days had also elapsed in the dream. Many things had happened in the North. I began, I know, with moody musings. Why, in spite of all, should I go back? Go back for all the rest of my days to toil and stress, insults and perpetual dissatisfaction, simply to save hundreds of millions of common people whom I did not love from the stress and anguish of war and infinite misrule? They all sought their own narrow ends, and why should not I? Why should not I also live as a man? And out of such thoughts her voice summoned me, and I lifted my eyes. I found myself awake and walking. We had come out above the pleasure city. We were near the summit of Monte Solaro and looking towards the bay. It was the late afternoon and very clear. All across the bay beyond Sorrento were the floating palaces of the pleasure city, moored and chained.
and northward were the broad floating stages that received the aeroplanes. Aeroplanes fell out of the sky every afternoon, each bringing its thousands of pleasure-seekers from the uttermost parts of the earth to Capri and its delights. But we noticed them only incidentally, because of an unusual sight that evening. 5 war aeroplanes that had long slumbered useless in the arsenals of the Rhinemouth were manoeuvring now in the eastward sky. Evesham had astonished the world by producing them and others, and sending them to circle here and there. It was the threat material in the great game of bluff he was playing, and it had taken even me by surprise. He was one of those incredibly stupid, energetic people who seemed sent by heaven to create disasters. I remember how we stood upon the headland, watching the squadron circling far away, and how I weighed the full meaning of the sight, seeing clearly the way things must go.